Kia ora, and welcome to Ghost Stories Aotearoa. I'm your host, Lisette Prende, fantasy author, actor, tarot reader, and self-confessed ghost obsessive. I believe there's a thin veil between the worlds of the living and the dead. And sometimes, the veil slips and the dead peek through. Have you ever seen a ghost? Have you ever seen something you can't explain? Something that made the hair on the back of your neck stand up? Something that kept you up at night? Well, our guests have. So, keep listening, if you dare. Welcome back to Ghost Stories Aotearoa. Today we're speaking to paranormal investigator and author Mark Warbank. With his teams Haunted Auckland and Paranormal New Zealand, Mark has undertaken more paranormal investigations than we can count, both in New Zealand and abroad. He's seen things, heard things, and felt things that would make most of us run screaming into the night. But Mark doesn't spook easy. Keep listening, if you dare.
I've always been into the paranormal. I've always been into things that are a little bit weird, a little bit odd. Normality was a bit dull to me. and I found that at school, my teachers weren't able to answer any of my questions because they just didn't know. And I started to realize how many unknowns there really were out there in this world. And so I started to find the world quite fascinating, more so from the unknown side of it all, you know, also not so much the known stuff. So I started to read books, mostly the kids' books, you know, as I was a 10-year-old kid, you know, just reading kids' books about ghosts and monsters and UFOs and all that kind of thing. And that was just totally fascinating. The first adult book I ever found, I was about 10 years old, and I found it in a secondhand shop. And it was called Confessions of a Ghost Hunter. And it was by Harry Price, and I read that and I was hooked. Even though I was just a 10-year-old kid I didn't understand a lot of the words, I was just hooked on the whole idea that somebody was out there investigating and actually looking into these things that I've been fascinated with as well. And up till then I didn't realize that people were actually going out and looking and searching and researching these things. I just thought they existed and that was the end of it. It wasn't until Ghostbusters came out, I think it was in the late 70s, and there was that opening scene. There's the opening scene there where they're in the library, mm-hmm. and they've got gadgets out and they're walking through and they're doing actual research. They're researching inside that library. And that scene there, that sparked it for me, just seeing guys out there actually researching ghosts in a location. And I hadn't really thought about it till then. I'd spent a lot of time in abandoned houses as a kid. Pretty much by myself. I lived in Howick, early Howick. My parents bought the first house up on one of the hills there, and it was all just paddocks and farmland. Wow. So there are a lot of burnt out old derelict farmhouses out there. And so I would go out and find these farmhouses, I'd hike through the bushes, find all these overgrown houses, and just go and sit in them. And it was just something about these houses that just drew me to them. And so I'd just go and sit in them, and they would just start asking questions, and I ended up I'd spent hours just sitting there talking and not really getting any answers, but just had this feeling that maybe something was there, and it kind of intrigued me. And it wasn't until I saw Ghostbusters and then read a few more books that people actually, I found out that people actually did go out there and research these things. I found out that I'm not the only one, you know, and there are actually people going out there and have careers and are doing this, you know, full time. So I found that totally fascinating. So I spent quite a few years I started a team of three people. It was just three mates of mine. This was about 1983-84. We started a small team. We were just called Auckland. It was Auckland Ghost Hunting Group. And we were just three of us. And we would go around to all these farmhouses and abandoned places and old factories and things. And we would just walk around with our torches. And I had a little audio recorder. and I had an old camera, those old cameras with the cubes, the flash cubes,
yeah.
of those, and we would just go around and we would just explore and take photographs, and that was my early research experience. So I've been doing field research since about age 10, doing actual field research, out in the field doing it. And then it was about 2009, I decided it'd be quite neat to get back into a team situation. So I started piecing together people, and that became Haunted Auckland. And a few people have come, a few people have left and have been replaced, and it's become what it is now.
So your approach with Haunted Auckland, would you call it like a scientific approach? Like, kind of, what's the kind of manifesto of Haunted Auckland? Is it from a spiritual approach or a medium channeling, or is it more of a scientific? What are your beliefs?
Well, the paranormal research as a whole is often just described as a pseudoscience. It's not really taken seriously by science, but there are ways of approaching it with a scientific attitude, and I try and get as scientific as I can by using the scientific method, which I feel is quite important to be used within this field, and a lot of teams don't use that. I think it needs some sort of format, some sort of system that you use, some sort of formula that you work through to try and prove or disprove and try and work through these things. So I guess I try a more scientific approach, I guess, but it's not 100% scientific because we're very limited to what we have to work with. Activity, true paranormal activity is very rare. I mean, a lot of people out there will say it happens all the time, but it doesn't. When you strip it back, there are a lot of rational explanations for things. So paranormal evidence is very hard to capture. And so the proof is very slim and it's very sparse. So you don't have much to work with. So you try and work with a formula, which is the scientific method, as best you can with the conditions and the what you have to work with. I'm not spiritual. I'm not religious or anything. So none of that sort of comes into it with me. But various team members might be a little bit more spiritually inclined. So they bring to it whatever they want to within the team. Everybody has their own personalities and their own levels of experience and skills and knowledge. But we do try and leave out any sort of personal bias within our experiments and our research. We try and keep religion out of it, try and keep any preconceived ideas out of it. We just try and work with what are the theories, let's work through these theories, let's just see what happens, let's just observe and see what happens, and just work with what you've got in front of you right there at that time.
Yeah,
that's
totally
pretty much how we handle it, yeah.
So you personally, you're saying you're not religious, so and do you consider yourself to be a believer in ghosts or spirits or an afterlife, or would you say you're a skeptic or a curious skeptic? Yeah, what are your personal beliefs around ghosts and the afterlife?
There was a time, maybe just a few years back, that I would say, well, I don't really know. And I spent a lot of time saying I don't know, because I think it's important in this field that if you don't know something, you say it. Don't try and make up stories or try and fit some sort of narrative into this whole belief system or whatever. I think call it as it is and be honest about it. So there was a time where I would say, I don't really know because I haven't seen enough. But through the years now, I've seen enough now to know that there is something in it. And do ghosts exist? Yes, I would say yes, ghosts do exist. And I've seen enough and experienced enough and observed enough for myself personally to know that ghosts do exist, but I don't know what they are. I don't know what causes them. I don't know why I'm seeing them or why I'm feeling the things or seeing the things or hearing the things. I don't know what they are. So that's the next step of my journey. Now I've decided that, yes, they do exist because, I mean, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people all over the world are experiencing them. Even in the most remote places where they don't have the influences of movies and books and television and the internet and all that. They don't have that influence, yet they're still seeing ghosts. And this has been going for like thousands of years. So I believe there is definitely something in it. And I think that, yes, ghosts, for whatever they are, do exist. But, the next step for me, is trying to figure out what they are. And if they are a legit actual entity as such, then let's try and communicate, let's try and find out about them, let's try and work with them, let's try and interact.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to do now, yeah.
Yeah, do you have any cool theories about what they could be? Because I kind of love theorizing about dimensional shifts and weird time-space continuum stuff and, you know, instead of just the whole spirits lingering. Yeah, do you have any cool theories like that yourself?
It changes, yeah. I mean, different. Every case is different. And there have been times where you think, well, this is obviously just some sort of imagery that's sort of replaying itself. They call it residual hauntings, where it's just like a section of time seems to be replaying itself, whether it be an image or a sound or something like that, seems to be replaying itself on a loop almost. Whether that's real or not, I don't know, but there have been times where we've experienced things that seem to be just almost like a recording, that we're hearing a recording of something happening, like a piano playing or somebody talking. There was one we did a couple of years back. It was at an old school in Auckland and had been shut down for many years. And we were doing a live feed. We're doing a Facebook live feed, and we had the phone was up in a toilet area and up in the toilets and the changing rooms upstairs. And our followers were saying that they could hear children. And this was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And they were hearing the sounds of children screaming and laughing and like in a playground. And they could hear it quite clearly. We couldn't hear it with our ears, but they were hearing it through the live feed electronically through the phone. So I went into the toilets with them, with the live feed going, and I couldn't hear it, but I put headphones on with my audio recorder. Putting headphones into an audio recorder automatically amplifies the sound that's coming into the audio recorder. And I could faintly hear the sound of kids playing in the playground. So it was almost like it was transmitting electronically to the gadgets, whether it be the phone or the recorder. So we're not too sure about that. So it's almost like a recording. Then we've had other experiences where something seems to be reacting with us and answering questions through various taps and light flashes and EMF meter triggers and things like this, and light triggers. We've had a lot of experience lately with little trigger push lights. And that seems to be a more intelligent interaction. We seem to be getting sort of replies to answers. Mm-hmm. And they don't seem to be just coincidental. They seem to be following some sort of patterns and formulas where you'll ask a question, you'll get a flashlight straight after in response, and no other flashes or responses outside of that. So it's interesting. So there's almost that, possibly some of it's maybe residual, some of it may be actually in there with you at that time. We don't really know, but it's interesting while it's happening anyway.
That is really interesting, because you can kind of, you know, when there's like an echo going on, you can kind of associate some kind of dimensional shift, repetitive leftover something. But when they are actually communicating with you, responding, that changes the theories a little bit, doesn't it? It's kind of like...
It does.
Okay, how do we explain this? That's quite crazy.
Yeah.
Cool. And what about the lights, the touch it lights you mentioned? I've seen them in other like YouTube investigations where you see they seem to be activated by touch or movement. Is that how they work?
The ones we've been using at the moment are just push lights. And I just found them online on eBay. They're about $1 each. They're just a little round one. Never had one. Not sure if I have one around here, but they're just a little round thing with a little push button on top. You push it and the light goes on, and you put them inside shelves and cupboards and things like that, just a little bit of extra light. And I just picked them up cheap off eBay and thought, oh, this might be a cheap little trigger object that we can use. Maybe you guys to be able to push the button, make the light go on. And we've done a few investigations now where we will ask a question and ask them to push the light and it'll go on. And the only way of turning that light on is by pushing the button down. So something is connecting that connection there to make the light go on by bypassing the actual push switch. So we're not too sure what's happening there. Something is causing a little bit of a electrical, whether it's because they're so cheaply made that the connection is quite, unstable and it's easily connected by heat. Maybe the heat is, as the light goes on, it will heat up. Metal expands and shrinks, so maybe the connection is We don't really know.
It seems kind of odd, right? Do they regularly just turn themselves on normally when you're not asking spirits to do it?
No, it doesn't turn off and on. It doesn't work at my house. It just works on, and it also doesn't work on every location, just a few locations that we've been in. There are lights that are very similar on the market that have remote controls. You can actually have a remote control which can, you can have them in a row, you can have a whole set of them, and they all change colour. You can set these lights up so that they change colour and they have little patterns, and so you can set them up almost like DJ lights with or party lights. The light I've got doesn't have any remote with it, and it's just a plain white light, very basic. But there are similar lights that have colours and patterns and things that you can program with a remote. So we're thinking that maybe there's something to do with the infrared of the beam. The infrared beam from the remote control has something to do with this. Maybe the infrared beams from our video cameras are somehow setting it off. That was one theory I came up with a while back, that maybe infrared is setting off my light. Because it sets off, because there are similar lights that use a remote control to set them off. So perhaps this is a similar thing using infrared, which is the same infrared that comes out of a remote control. But we don't know. Again, we don't know. The trigger light activity has been quite intriguing to me, because I haven't been able to find an answer to why my trigger lights are going on. The most intriguing incident we had with the push lights recently, it was just a few months ago, just a couple of us were at the Lake House Art Centre, where we've spent quite a bit of time in the past year or two. And Amy, one of the team members, brought along some dominoes. There's a story about a young girl that's often seen in the stairs and playing in the hallways, and she's seen quite often. So we've been doing a lot of communication sessions there, trying to figure out who she is. And we've figured out that her name might be Patty or Patricia. She likes to be called Patty, so we've actually got a name for her now. And Amy brought along a whole bunch of toys, and she brought along a set of dominoes. And we've got this whole session, which lasts for, I guess, about 20 minutes, of Amy sitting on the floor using the push lights as the push light would be Patty, and asking Patty to choose, pick a domino and play the game. And Amy ended up losing to Patty. Somehow the ghost won.
Whoa.
So we don't know what happened there, but we caught it all on film. It's on our YouTube page, which is, it's quite interesting. We had a few different camera angles there, but the light wasn't flashing outside of any of these questions or anything, just when I was focused on that game. So
that's incredible. What's your YouTube handle?
Just Haunted Auckland.
Haunted Auckland YouTube
channel. Haunted Auckland, yeah. Just go to YouTube, yeah. So we've had some interesting little interactions there. Of course, with none of them, we never say that we're interacting with ghosts, because we don't know. As Carl Sagan once said, Carl Sagan, famous scientist, but once said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Mm.
And so for us to say that a place is haunted, or this is definitely a ghost, we have to have the evidence to back it up. And at this stage, a flashing light isn't really enough evidence to place it on. So got to be careful how we word things.
Yeah, I guess. But then there must be times where you're just like, wow, that's interesting.
We've had a lot of very, very intriguing incidents where we've seen things and heard things and felt things and experienced things. But you still, to keep your reputation clean, you just can't go out there. Especially when it comes to the media, we've had journalists and news media, that they get one little snippet of information and they sort of expand on it, and it makes you look like a fool. So we have to be very careful what we say out there, I guess.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's definitely, unexplained paranormal activity, but I guess that's the whole idea, isn't it? It's definitely weird, but yeah.
And then again, it's unexplained by us.
Yeah.
Who's to say that there isn't somebody out there that can explain it?
Yeah, or in another 100 years, someone finds more science and goes, ha ha, I know.
That's right. Well, this is why we network. We network with a lot of teams all over the world. And if we have something that we can't figure out, we'll send it to this team and we'll say, what do you guys think? Have you experienced anything like this at all? Because we're all learning from each other and all the teams are sort of connected, and we all try and share our experiences where we can and information. And hopefully we can learn from each other.
Yeah. Do you have any teams where your values or your beliefs don't align, and so you're kind of like,
Yeah, I know a lot of very spirity teams that are into their spirit boxes and all their angels and demons and all that kind of thing, which isn't really my thing. But I, you know, you just learn to respect other people's beliefs and views, and that not everybody is going to investigate the same way I investigate.
Yeah.
And everybody's learning. We're all learning. Mm. I mean, I've been doing this for, I mean, I'm 53 now, and I've been doing it since I was, what, 10? So, and I'm still learning, you know, and I still don't know what ghosts are. We're all learning from each other. One day the answers will come, but you've got to be very patient.
Yeah, totally. You mentioned the spirit box. I have heard of this. And when I heard of it, I have to admit, I was kind of like, yeah, not convinced. So what are your thoughts on the spirit box and how it works?
They've been long proven to be, to not deliver what, you know, they claim to deliver. They're pretty much, it's an old idea. It's basically a radio that has been hacked so that instead of digitally scanning through the stations when you push a button, you basically snip one wire inside it, which allows it to randomly zoom through this, the channels by itself randomly. So it sort of skips quickly through all the stations automatically. And it's the theory is that within all that noise and white noise and distortion and cut-ups of radio frequencies and all that distortion, that the spirits can use that to form words and phrases. And but really it's just using snippets of words from songs and radio DJs and people, you know, talkback radio and even, you know, taxi cabs. They used to pick up taxis and, you know, truck drivers on CB radios, that kind of thing. So it's just snippets of words that can be, if you hear them at close range, you know, sort of cut together, they could sound like words. You might get one piece from one bit of speech, added onto a snippet from a song, you know, and it might just sort of sound like a word. If it's zooming through the channels fast enough, it's called pareidolia. Pareidolia is where your brain just creates some sort of rational thing out of something that originally seems like chaos.
Yeah.
Very much like, you know, you'll see a teddy bear in the sky in the clouds. Yeah. It's just like a cloud that looks like a teddy bear. Yeah, it's your brain or seeing a face, you know, in a tree or something. It's just your brain looking at something. It's like facial recognition on your camera. Your camera will put circles around anything it thinks is a face. It's kind of like facial recognition, but with audio. So a lot of people are hearing these things and they want to hear words and they want to hear phrases. And so words and sounds come through and it sounds like something to them. They'll hear it and they'll interpret what they want from that noise. They'll create this word or a phrase, and then they'll try and work it around the narrative or work some sort of narrative around the situation that they're in. So for example, we've had a lot of them where spirit box will be making all these noises. It'll suddenly say water, and that'll be all you'll hear, and they'll go, water, okay, did you drown? There's a river nearby. Did you drown in the river? Okay, they drowned in the river. And then the next word that comes through, they try and add that to the story.
Yeah.
And the story keeps growing and growing and growing, you know, till you end up with this whole big sort of deluded sort of bed of just story, which may be, you know, far from the truth. Now, nowadays you get the spirit boxes have evolved a bit more now where they've got Bluetooth and they have apps connected to them. And those apps will have built-in libraries of pre-recorded sounds. So you've got all these pre-recorded phrases and sounds and spooky effects that you can add to make it echoey and all that. So, they're getting more and more involved and more
kind of seems a little bit more, even a little bit more slanted that way then, doesn't it? Like if it's already got a pre-recorded set of really cool sounds to...
They're becoming more entertainment.
I'd heard that they were actually
fun.
Set up to have your typical phrases like I'm cold, know what you'd expect ghosts to say, and so the legitimacy is very questionable. Looking at your website, you've done a lot of investigations all over New Zealand and some overseas. And there's quite a few that sounded really quite spooky, for want of a better term. Like particularly the Waitomo Hotel. Could you tell me a bit about your experiences there?
We've done that a couple of times now. It's actually shut down during lockdowns. Yeah. I think it's been closed for quite a while. Whether they open or not, I don't know. But we've done a couple there, and it's a very intriguing place with a lot of stories. You can talk to the cleaners there and the staff. They'll tell you some amazing stories. Yeah, everything from a Maori princess that's seen on the driveway leading up to the Waitomo Caves. There was one time where a cleaner had gone into a room after a couple had left, and just to clean up, and the bathtub was just full of blood. And so she ran out screaming and in panic, and the manager and her came back up to the room, and it was clear. There was nothing in it. So lots of things like this. There's lots of shadow people seen there, lots of sounds of footsteps, lots of, lots of entities sort of seen roaming the hallways and found in rooms through the years. When we've stayed there, we didn't really have too much happen, just a few noises and clicks and bangs and the usual sort of sounds that you'd get with an old building. But it's just such an amazing place with an amazing history. So we're hoping to get back there again sometime when they reopen.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the time there's such an amazing energy from old homes or buildings that we're not used to being in, that you kind of go in and you feel this vibe of age, because, I mean, you're stimulated by old visual things and feels, so that can kind of add to it. But it is, that in itself is kind of quite cool. Old buildings are cool anyway, like you do get a vibe from them. Yeah.
But even new buildings, sort of new build buildings can be haunted as well, because it's all dependent on the land. We've investigated places where the house is probably only a couple of decades old, and the sort of the haunting sort of history that's there, the things that seem to be haunting the place and the stories that we're hearing sort of give the idea that maybe the ghost is quite old. It's quite an old ghost with an old history. So you think, obviously that ghost didn't live in this house because it was a recently built house. So what was on that land before that? So there may have been a farmhouse or, some other place that burned to the ground, and, things may have happened there. There could be a cemetery under there that nobody knows about, who knows?
That's an interesting point, because we do always assume that like spirits or ghosts would stay with the building that they're familiar with, and that's kind of the whole idea of the haunted house concept, really, isn't it? They're tied to the house in some way. But I have talked to other people for the podcast that have experienced something like that they believe to be paranormal or ghosts in like the bush, like in the middle of nowhere. And so, there is like a tie to maybe land or who knows, but it does seem to be not necessarily contained to buildings, which is quite cool. What would you say has been your most, some of your most interesting, unexplainable, spooky experiences when investigating in New Zealand?
I've stayed at some of the most haunted places around the world, and honestly, I've slept so well in those places. no problems. Nothing's ever happened while I've been there. I think it depends on your level of naivety and experience, I guess, and that, if you know what to look for. Now, if you go on a total ghost believer and not knowing anything of, house noises and buildings and architecture and plumbing and that kind of thing, you'll jump at any sound. So I think I've trained myself to sort of erase all those natural noises and sounds and within buildings, which I guess kind of makes it a bit dull, I guess. A bit of a spoiler, I guess, but... It's the places that we have repeat visits. There have been quite a few buildings that, like the old school I was talking about earlier, for example, that one there was one we had over 2 years. We had the lease for that one for 2 years, and we did over about 20-something investigations of that one, about 20-something investigations and over 2 years. And every time we would go back, something new would happen. And it was almost like whatever was there was becoming sort of familiar, and maybe perhaps even more comfortable with us being there, so that they would open up a bit more and interact a bit more. Because every time we were there, things would happen. And so I found that one really interesting, because we had over those 2 years, we had so much happen.
Wow.
Nothing huge, like nothing amazing and incredible, but just like little intriguing things that would happen that through the years you sort of document this whole sort of list of activity. All the places I've stayed in that have had the reputation of being the most haunted place haven't given me any activity at all.
Right.
But it's the most unassuming places that you think that you don't actually have any stories. Like, for example, there was the Smith and Coe's building in Queen Street. That was a building that I just approached out of the blue. I just sort of I knew about that building and I hadn't really heard any ghost stories, but I just sort of approached the manager there and said, look, have you heard any ghost stories here? We'd love to come and have a look around. You know, it's a place that's intrigued me for many years. And he told me all these stories about how, yes, the place is haunted and how a lot of the staff down in the basement often see shadow people and things are moving around. So it's places like that that you don't hear about.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of hotels as well that you'll just ring or I'll stay in a hotel for a night somewhere on holiday and I'll just ask them, have you had any activity here? And the amazing stories that come from that, you know, that nobody really hears about. They're kind of local stories.
Yeah, they keep it kind of under wraps a little bit. I guess it's not like a public place.
The most intriguing places have been the places that aren't really advertised as being haunted.
It's interesting, eh?
Yeah.
So what kind of activity did you have in the Smith & Coe's building?
Well, we sort of found the source of a lot of that activity. We kind of debunked a lot of that because most of the activity was confined to down in the basement in the inwards goods area where all the stock would be delivered down in the basements. It was like a whole maze underground. It's like a labyrinth of tunnels underneath. And it's just this huge area where the trucks would back in, unload boxes and boxes of stock. You know, then they would be labeled and priced and all that kind of thing. And then they'd go upstairs to the main department store. And this is where people were experiencing the most activity. But down in that basement is a huge power generator, which generates the whole of the Smith & Coe's building. And it's the size of a house. It's massive. It's just this massive big power generator that's huge. And it's the size of a good-sized truck, a massive truck. And it's just down in the basement right next to where everyone's working. And the EMF levels were just ridiculous. It was just our EMF meters were going crazy before we even saw the thing, before we even saw what it was. And people are working down there. And so high EMF levels can cause you to feel nausea, hallucinate. It can really mess with your mind, feel dizzy and all sorts. So, yeah, it's that we found that quite intriguing. The high EMF levels there could possibly be the answer there, causing people to hallucinate, but we don't know.
Wow, that's an interesting theory, though. So the workers who had felt like they were feeling chills or dizziness or all of the things you'd associate to some sort of spirit activity could very well have been reacting to the energy field.
Yeah, paranoia, anxiety, all sorts of stuff. Yeah, people start feeling dizzy and sick, and you know, I mean, I've felt EMF sickness myself, and a couple of places where you don't realise what's in that cupboard, and in that cupboard there might be a whole lot of electronic equipment. You could be standing right there, and all of a sudden you start feeling dizzy, like you're going to collapse, and then you find out that it's the EMF that's coming out of that closet. It can really affect you. It's quite crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of spooky in itself, isn't it, to think about like how much the electricity is actually affecting you as it is. Yeah, and you were saying about the EMF device, the electromagnetic field device, is that it? Yeah. Can you tell me a bit about how it works and like the science around it and why it's used in like paranormal research?
Well, I mean, one of the theories that around ghosts is that they are created with energy. They are made of energy and they absorb energy. They absorb it to manifest and things like that. So they're energy based. That's just one theory. So we kind of work with that and see if we can get anything from that. On the market, you can buy EMF meters, which are electromagnetic field meters, and they are used by electricians, plumbers, builders, you know, to check for wiring and check the EMF levels within the home. So we can use this to try and work out our theories. I mean, everything in your house, everything that's locked into your power grid within your house, whether it be microwave ovens, fridges, televisions, computers, they're all hooked up to your power grid in your house. So they're all giving off their own EMF fields.
Right.
Everything gives off an EMF field around it. And your EMF meter will detect that. Now, if you're in an area that there are no wires, no power lines, nothing electrical, nothing at all, and your EMF meter is going off, then you need to look into, okay, why? Why is it being set off? Yeah, there is no power source, so why would this be set off? So you have to look at other sources, you know, what actually could be causing it. And there are weather factors, there are like atmospheric conditions that can cause it to go off. Your cell phone in your pocket can create, you know, cause it to go off. So you're sort of using it to try and find any sort of random energies that may be sort of roaming around that aren't something rational or sort of building, explainable, having said that, we don't know if ghosts are energy. It's just a theory. So you just work with the theories. You work with the theories and you use the gadgets that are out there on the market pretty much to work through those theories.
Yeah, that sounds
it's
really
a long
cool
process. Yeah.
So when you're doing a investigation or a ghost hunt, do you try and make sure there's no power going? Like, would you turn power off in a home and stuff like that?
Yeah, we try to where we can. Of course, you can't always do that. You can't turn fridges and freezers off and stuff. We make sure our cell phones are turned off. We're on flight mode as well. We put them on flight mode. And we try and keep anything electrical, like our cell phones and any gadgets that we might have, away from the data gathering gadgets. So like EMF meters, we'll keep away from anything that may be giving off a large sort of amount of EMF or have its own energy field. So we try and control the environment as much as we can, but it's not always easy.
I noticed that you went to Napier Prison.
Yep, done that a few times, yep.
Yeah, so is that prison still being used as a prison?
Not as a prison. It's a tourist attraction now. They've opened it up to the public and they do tours and things there. We've been there a few times. I spent a night myself there, just solo.
Wow, overnight.
Yeah. I like to kind of challenge myself a bit. And so I do a lot of solo investigating as well. But yeah, we've had the team go there a few times. We've done a couple of public events there as well. And I've done a solo overnight stay there, just sleeping in one of the cells. And we've had some interesting activity, again, from footsteps to cell doors being slammed to just, you can see shadow people walking around the place. It's quite interesting. Things do happen there. It's a very intriguing place, especially when you're there by yourself and you know that you're the only person you're locked in there and you're the only one there. And you start hearing footsteps walking down the hallway and things like that.
Yeah. So
it's an interesting place. Whether it's actually truly haunted, I don't know. Okay, again, we don't have enough evidence, but things do happen.
Yeah, I got to say, if I was somewhere like that by myself overnight and I was hearing footsteps and seeing shadow people, I probably wouldn't be that calm and scientific.
No, you do get used to it after a while. I mean, you become quite sort of, blasé about the whole thing, really. And after a while, you get used to the dark. I mean, the only thing I really fear about it all is who could be in that building. It could be some homeless person living in there that might not like you going in there, or, you don't know who's going to be there, especially if it's a derelict old building and, you don't know who's there. But once you've sort of walked around and you've got the feeling of the place and done a bit of an explore first to check out every single room, you get more sort of used to the place and familiar with it. The fear goes.
The fear goes. Okay.
It does.
So with the shadow people, is it like out of the corner of your eye, or are you actually seeing like what looks like human figures?
Well, the ones we've seen, most of them have been short, like childlike. The first sort of shadow that I would consider a shadow person, I saw when I was about 10 years old. That was in an old house. And that was a very tall person. And that sort of came towards me. And that was my first experience with a shadow that moved and basically moved towards me. And as it passed through me or around me, it was just totally cold. This was as a 10-year-old child, I sort of felt that. So that was very cool. That was a neat experience. It opened my eyes up to the idea that shadow people, it could be ghosts and that kind of thing, and that ghosts could come in that form. Since that, I've only really seen short ones, little child-sized shadows. We've done a few private home residential investigations where we've seen children run around, and those are the same children that the residents there claim to have seen. They say that they see childlike shadows running around, and we've seen those same sort of sized shadows. Recently we've had the Patty at the Lake House Art Centre. A lot of people have seen short shadows running around the place, and we've seen those same short shadows. And we've had a couple of investigators join us at various times as well who have both seen little short shadows. So, yeah, we're seeing a lot of children shadows, which is interesting.
Oh, Yeah, that is interesting.
Not so much, not so many adult sized.
Wow, but that's still quite, you know, not your average sort of occurrence, seeing these shadow people when you're doing these investigations. Yeah. That's pretty cool. Wow, do they show up on camera? Do you?
Most of the time, it's sort of we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, evidence, collecting evidence for this is the hardest thing. It's you really need to have the right piece of equipment in your hand running at that very moment, at the right time to capture it. And that doesn't always happen. So many times where you'll see something with your eyes, but you won't have the right gadget running right in front of you. You'll be holding a camera, but it won't be switched on, or you'll be changing the batteries and then you'll see it. Most of the time you see them with both eyes. There's been a few times where I've seen something at the corner of my eye, and then I'll turn to look at it and I'll be seeing it with both eyes. And it'll actually last for just a few seconds, but enough to sort of recognize that, yep, something is definitely there. What it is, I don't know, but I'm seeing with both eyes, and I'm acknowledging that, yes, something is there. Numerous times we've heard at the Hauck Historical Village, there's a place called Puanui Homestead. Mm. And we've done quite a few investigations at the Puanui Homestead and within the village itself. And we've done a lot of solo investigations there, where each team member would spend a night by themselves in Puanui Homestead. And quite a few other investigators have, including myself, have heard the footsteps walking down the stair, walking down the hallway. I wrote about one incident in my last book where I went to go to the toilet. I went to go for a pee and walked down the hallway into the toilet. And soon after that, I heard some footsteps walking down the hallway towards me, like that somebody was following after me into the toilet. So I stopped peeing, held it, and the footsteps stopped. And that was that. There was a good sort of 7 or 8 footsteps sort of that you could hear stomp, 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 getting closer and closer to the toilet, but nobody was there. We've had one of the other ladies that was in the team at the time, she was doing an overnight by herself, and she said she stood looking down the hallway, thinking about where she's going to place her next audio recorder, and all of a sudden it was the clip-clop of hard-heeled shoes walking down the hallway towards her from one end of the hallway to where she was standing in the lounge. And she said that she heard it getting louder and louder as it got closer and closer, and it was definite footsteps with purpose walking down the hallway. So things like that happen, you know, and whether it's a residual thing, we don't know, but it sounds like it's definitely something physical on that hard wooden floor. It's almost a physical thing. Like, so it really is, it's almost that, like, it's not a recording because it's physically hitting that floorboard. You can hear it going clip, clop, clip, clop. So it's almost like it really is happening in real time.
In real time. And when this happens, do you kind of rush out and try and see what you can find, see where it's coming from? I guess it's so fast, it's hard to...
Yeah, usually they only last a few seconds.
Yeah.
And most of the time we've found that you end up sort of missing out on it because you're too busy watching it or listening to it happening that you don't want to turn away and try and look for a camera or a recorder because you want to soak it all in. You want to, you know, you want to observe it, the whole thing, while it's happening. So a lot of the time it just happens when you're not ready for it.
Yeah. And have you managed to like try and debunk the footsteps, or have you just kind of been like, okay?
No, we've tried numerous times.
Yeah.
We had in the same building, actually, we had a torch thrown down the stairs. We caught that on film, actually. We had it recorded. The only thing we didn't capture was the torch actually coming off the chair that it was sitting on and making its way down the stairs. We saw the last bit where it got slammed against the wall. So the video camera down the bottom of the stairs captured that. But the actual lifting off the chair and then moving around and moving around to that point where it got slammed, all you can hear is the sound. But there's a good 9 minutes of all this action happening before the slamming of the torch. It's quite incredible. That was when I was staying by myself. It was an overnight stay at Puanui Homestead.
Right.
And it was good. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I decided to get a few hours sleep. And just after about 3, you hear the clock chiming 3. And then you start hearing all this noise upstairs. It's like shuffling and dragging, and like somebody's dragging a chest of drawers or something across the ground. And there's like footsteps and creaks and like a metal bucket clanging sound. And there's all this noise of creaking floorboards. There was nobody up there, of course, because I was the only one in the house. And all the windows are sealed. And it wasn't until just after three where I heard the slam, and that's where the torch has been thrown. That's what woke me up. That's when I go and have a look and find that the torch is down the bottom of the stairs. And the next morning I go back and go through all that footage, and that's when I hear all the sound happening up there prior to that, with 9 minutes worth of sound, like something, somebody's definitely up there. It's incredible.
That is incredible. So there's just a torch sitting on a chair, and you've got no real explanation about how it was thrown off the chair and down the stairs.
And it's not even a round torch. It's a flat torch. And it's a flat blue torch with a button on top, and it just basically sits flat, so it can't roll.
Okay.
So it's really, we couldn't figure it out.
Wow.
But that's the nature of this field. Yeah, things happen. You've got to try and figure it out. And so a lot of the time, you just can't.
Wow.
And a journalist caught on to it. They saw, I made a video of the torch being thrown down the stairs. And I didn't say anything about a ghost. I just said that torch got thrown down the stairs.
Mm.
And a journalist saw it and made a story about it, and which I thought was quite nice. But then they went and got a few comments from the Skeptic Society. And of course the Skeptic Society said, oh, those people see ghosts everywhere. Yeah, everything is a ghost to them. All, you know, there could be hundreds of explanations for that happening. And but they didn't name one.
Yeah.
And I approached the skeptic after that, saying, well, you obviously have an explanation. Can I hear it? Because I've got no explanations. I'd like to hear what your explanations were. And we heard nothing. We heard nothing back. So,
I think sometimes being a skeptic is actually being quite closed-minded, you know, like, you know, there's no room for curiosity when you commit to being a full-on skeptic. So it's kind of like...
Right. Well, they've already made up their minds. They've made up their minds that ghosts don't exist, and nothing you say will change that.
Yeah.
And anything you do say, they'll just find some sort of fault, or they'll just put a little label on it and say, oh, no, that was obviously just a sleep disorder. Something you obviously dreamed it.
Yeah.
We had one guy, I had one incident where I saw, I was telling you about how I saw a grey mass walking along a hallway in the old, it was in the old school as well. And it's a grey mist that sort of passed across the hallway in front of me, only for about a second or so, but enough for me to see that it was like a grey mist that sort of just cruised past and went into one of the rooms. And I sort of mentioned that online, and some skeptic came on and said, "You obviously fell asleep." And he said that it's possible for somebody to fall asleep for like a split second. You'll just fall asleep and you'll wake up and you'll dream things. And I thought, well, at the time I saw it, I was setting up a video camera on a tripod.
Yeah.
I was standing there actually doing things, and I saw it and I watched it. And so now they're saying that I fell asleep for about a half a second enough to dream what I think I saw. And to me, that just doesn't really weigh up. It's just...
Yeah, that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, there are accounts, you know, you hear about the ghost sightings where people are in bed a lot, and they see figures approach them in bed, and you know there's room to sort of suggest maybe there's something going on sleep wise with those. But then if you're literally standing up just
and walking around and doing
walking
stuff
around, I think that's a stretch.
Wow,
that is I guess you're right when you say that things can't be explained, but you don't quite know what it is. But it sounds pretty strange.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. And I noticed
it's
you
the
went
nature
to,
of the game, really, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, when you, I noticed you went to King's Seat Psychiatric Hospital, which is, that's now Spookers? Is that the?
Oh, the Spookers is one of the buildings in that complex. It's a psychiatric building that closed down about a good 30 years ago. A lot of history there, a lot of very dark history. And we've investigated quite a few of the different villas and buildings throughout the that complex there. It's a massive building. I can't remember, it's about 50 buildings or something.
Oh, wow.
About 50 buildings. There's a morgue and all sorts of stuff there. So we've investigated quite a number of those, and a lot of them are rented out because it's quite an old sort of decrepit sort of, you know, sort of old hospital now. It's not, a lot of the buildings are rotting and decaying a bit. So they rent them out very cheap to sort of low-income families and all that. So you'll get about three or four families living in some of them, because they've got like 10 bedrooms and there'll be like four or five bathrooms, and they're massive places. They're huge, big hospital villas.
Yeah.
And so we've spent quite a few nights investigating various villas and just seeing what we can find. We're trying to make our way through the whole complex, the whole hospital complex there, before it all gets pulled down, because eventually it's going to be torn down. Yeah, they're planning a big sort of a big sort of whole new suburb there. A sort of housing complex and all that. So a lot of those buildings are going to go. So we're trying to document them as much as we can.
Yeah.
And
Much activity.
We've had a lot of experience. Yeah, we've had quite a bit of activity there. Again, lots of bits and pieces, and they're old buildings as well. So it's hard to say whether it's just building movement, creaks and groans and all that sort of stuff. And there are a lot of pigeons living in them now because they're, you know, nature's starting to come inside now. So you've got all, you know, pigeons there living in them. So there's lots of things that can make noises, possums and things. But yeah, it's a fascinating place. So we're going to keep going back there as often as we can, just to try and soak up as much as we can before it's gone.
Cool. Yeah.
There are a lot of places like that around the country that are just very old and they often get torn down. We have this thing in New Zealand where if something is old, you pull it down and make an apartment.
Yeah.
Or a car park, you know, and it's a real shame. Yeah.
Such a shame. There's so many of them.
Yeah.
There was one Erskine College in Wellington, where I live in Island Bay. Beautiful old building. So incredible, and it was an art school for many years, and I'm pretty sure there were some ghost hunting going on because a lot of the staff who worked in the art school were seeing things and hearing things, and there was a chapel and stuff like that. But then it was earthquake prone, so it got pulled down. So same sort of thing, really. So it's such a shame.
I went there once but couldn't get in. It was all locked up. I've got a friend down in Wellington there called James Gilbert. James Gilbert, he runs Strange Occurrences Paranormal. And so I guess I go down to Wellington quite often to see him and do an investigation or two.
I noticed you did Inverlochy House.
Yes, many years ago. That was with James. Yeah, that was great. A neat place.
Yeah, that's actually actually go there to do art classes. So when I saw that on the list, I was like, oh, I'm curious about this. So did you have any interesting activity there?
Not really. Nothing really happened for us there. But then again, there are sort of flats upstairs where a few people were living. So you get noises coming from up there as well, where people are living with their televisions going and walking around. So it's not really a controlled environment to be working in, but just the stories. I like the stories and I like how it looks inside. And it's just a neat old place.
It is, yeah. And I've got to admit that when I went there, I didn't feel anything really. I just thought this is a cool building, but I didn't kind of get any ominous vibe of presence really lurking around me. But then when I saw it on the list, I was like, "Ooh, that's interesting."
Yeah, there are stories. There's some interesting stories there. A few sightings and things. Yeah.
Cool. And is there any investigation you've done in New Zealand that's, you know, just really put the shits up you and just being like, okay, this feels, there's a lot going on and I'm kind of creeped out? Have you ever had that, or are you just so kind of?
No, not really. It's, I think I'm sort of beyond that now. I guess I've grown out of it, where with experience you sort of harden up a bit and you become very sort of immune to it all, I guess. It just doesn't faze you. And so I can sort of walk into any old dark place and just not really feel anything. I just like the exploration. I just love exploring and checking places out. And so I'll sort of go into all areas and have a nosy around everywhere I can. And I don't know. I haven't really found a place sort of scary. I get more of a rush, really. It's more of a, you get a bit more of an adrenaline rush where you go, wow, that was amazing. Wow, that was so cool. That was so cool. Wow. And you want it to happen again, you know. I have these big dreams. You know, I really want to have some major paranormal activity. I'm a big fan of the old sort of poltergeists. I love poltergeists. And I love the concept of poltergeists. And so I always sort of live in hope that I'll get to experience some full-on poltergeist activity. I mean, I had a torch getting thrown down the stairs. Maybe that was. I don't know. But I quite like the idea of poltergeists. So one day I'm hoping I'll experience something very physical like that.
Yeah. Very physical. Yeah, so you haven't really had any of those physical sensations of either being touched or things being turned on or things being...
Well, we've had a few touches. A few sort of light touches. Nothing too amazing. But there's been... I was grabbed on the shoulder once by sort of a hand on my shoulder.
And that didn't faze you? You didn't, like, freak out?
No, because I thought it was one of the team members. I thought a team member had come up behind me. It was that Kingseed, actually. We were down walking down a corridor, and it was total darkness, and I had my infrared camera on me, and so I was the only way that I was the only one that could see anything. I could see it on my tiny little screen on my camera, because it was infrared. I could see night vision, and so I was making my way down this hallway. And then all of a sudden, I felt a hand sort of grab me on the shoulder. I thought it was one of the ladies from the team. I thought she'd come up behind me, and she was putting her hand on my shoulder because I was the only one that could see where we were going in the dark. And sort of spun around, and the team was down the other end of the hallway. Nobody was there. So that was interesting.
That's one word, nice. Right?
Yeah, it is. It's great because you can feel the fingers. You can. It's like you can rule out sort of nerves. Mm. I knew it wasn't nerves, and I was holding a camera in my hand. So I knew I didn't have any sort of shoulder straps on or anything sort of on my shoulders. And it just felt like somebody from behind just sort of putting their hands on my shoulder, like they were peering over my shoulder or just hanging on to me to see where I was going. So you get a bit of a rush there when you know that it's nothing human and you know that it definitely wasn't one of the team. It's like, wow, that was incredible. Wow, that was neat. I don't know what it was. I don't know what I experienced, but wow, that was kind of cool.
That's all we have time for this week, but we're not done.
And these knocking sounds were coming from everywhere, from up above us, below us, around us, behind us.
Stay tuned for part two of our interview with Mark Wallbank, coming soon. Subscribe to be notified of when the next episode drops. In the meantime, you might want to check out Haunted Auckland on YouTube and on Facebook. We've linked them in our show notes, so go and check them out, if you dare. Thanks for listening to Ghost Stories Aotearoa. If you enjoyed this episode, hit the subscribe button to be notified when our next episode drops. Ghost Stories Aotearoa is produced by Spectre Media and hosted by me, Lisette Prende, with music by James from Dr. Bad Film, a podcast about bad movies. If you have a ghost story you'd like to share with us, please get in touch at ghoststoriesaotearoa@gmail.com. Tune in again next week for Ghost Stories Aotearoa. That is, if you dare.